Campus FM presents the final talk in the Work in Progress seminar series. The talk is entitled, God Protect Me from Friends, Prelates, Politicians and Psychologists in Contemporary Malta. And it is delivered by Dr. Mark Anthony Falzon.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Tonight, we bring to an end our 10th anniversary celebration of seminars, which are known as the seminar series Work in Progress in the Social Studies. They're colloquially known as WIPS. I don't know whether that colloquialism is a good thing or a bad thing, but there it is.
Maybe today it is.
I think today it will be a very appropriate title for Dr. Mark Anthony Falzon's talk. 10 years ago, Work in Progress in the Social Studies seminars were started by Dr. David Zamit, lecturer in law and anthropology, and by myself. We had two aims. The first aim was to provide informal discussion for researchers in the social studies in front of a friendly audience. The second aim was to act as an interface or link between university researchers in the social studies and the Maltese community. I like to think the first remains. We are still informal, and I hope we are still friendly. The second aim was given a big boost 3 years ago by one of our co-conveners, Dr. Vicky Ann Cremona. Vicky Ann got the seminars onto Campus FM. It is strange how often in places where I shouldn't be, discos, dark places, people come up to me through the smoke and say, I heard that very interesting seminar in the Work in Progress series. Or perhaps as my jaw is opened and subject to the instruments of my dentist, he will go into a long analysis of some seminar. Not the most convenient or safe place. But I think all in all, we are friendly, informal, and we are getting out to the community. A lot of people seem to be listening out there. Tonight, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker, who will be reading a paper called, very provocatively, God Protect Me from My Friends, Prelates, Politicians, and Psychologists in Contemporary Malta. Announcement went on to say that Dr. Falzon would be discussing the expansion of state welfare into new areas, and he would be discussing the idea that social web represents new forms of state-church relations. Mark, the title is very exciting, but the description is very dry. Aren't we going to get, if not sex, at least some violence? Isn't there going to be blood on the carpet?
Definitely sex. I'm not sure about violence.
I mean, I think you've got ghouls in front of you here tonight. We want names named. It gives me great pleasure to introduce...
Safe sex, though, as
good. Safe sex, okay. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Mark. Mark Anthony Falzon was the first student to get a first-class degree in anthropology from the University of Malta. He went on to get not merely a distinction in his MPhil in anthropology at Cambridge, but the best Master of Philosophy distinction that Cambridge had given for 10 years. He then went on to get a PhD in anthropology from Cambridge, and that PhD has been published by Brill as Cosmopolitan Connections. He continues to publish widely in various academic journals on his special themes, changing global society and changing nature of the city in various parts of the world in a global society. But tonight he is going to zoom in very much on home, on Malta, and we look forward to what Mark has to say.
Thanks, Ford. Thank you. Thanks for the breathtaking introduction. I shall be reading the paper, so it should take me about an hour, I think. I haven't timed it, but it should take me about an hour. So we'll have some time for questions after. In the last couple of decades or so, Maltese society has been permeated by a new sense of order. If the old one was based on religion, the new one represents a coming together of the increasing power of the state over domestic and personal matters, a vision of social order based on popular psychology and the appropriation by the Catholic Church of a range of welfare initiatives. Today's talk, which in truth belongs to a work in an early stage of progress seminar, is intended as an exploration of this intersection. My contention is that it is the site of production of a large chunk of social policy in contemporary Malta. The descriptive part of the talk deals with the new directions that the state is taking towards a more rigid control and a more active production of individual bodies, families, and communities. I also look at the proliferation of skills and the professions that produce and or protect them. Finally, I discuss the newly discovered role of the Catholic Church as moralist, sociologist, and psychologist combined. My personal antipathy towards the more extreme forms of welfareism notwithstanding, I shall refrain from arguing that there is anything particularly insidious about the welfare structures and policies I describe. As Janowitz states, liberal journalists and social scientists of the hard-headed school are typically occupied with uncovering plots and understanding the realities of power. When dealing with such topics, it is in fact very easy to lapse into a conspiracy theory of social control that views the state, in collusion with the church in this case, as a devious agent of power, and the people as innocent fools dancing to its tune. In my discussion, I hope to avoid such a simplistic view, partly by maintaining a certain aloofness of description and partly by using a model of social control that transcends bearded lefty formulations. Our first task is to look at the model which the various discourses and practices of welfare are rooted in. Social welfare is, after all, always based on some historical, cultural idea of what society should look like. In the national rhetoric and discourse on welfare, the model society brings on stage three main actors: the individual, the family, and the community. Their characters are mediated through a dual hegemony of church and state that operates on many levels. It is, of course, beyond the scope of this talk to trace in detail the techniques of power that construct the correct, docile model individual. I shall limit myself to mentioning a few empirical instances. There is no doubt that the individual is increasingly being seen as the prime locus of physical and psychological well-being. Health promotion is now a central aspect of public health. Individuals are constantly encouraged to count calories, monitor their body mass index, calculate health risks from smoking, active and passive, and cholesterol-rich foods, etc. The weather report now includes a reading of the UV index, on the basis of which people are expected to take precaution, not least by matching it with an appropriately factored sun cream. Many aspects of health are being constructed in terms of lifestyle. The big four being to stop smoking and avoid people who do or who don't, to eat a healthy diet, to drink alcohol in moderation, and to take regular exercise. It follows logically that the growing emphasis on individual self-control and lifestyle goes hand in hand with the rise in fortunes of the notion of individual responsibility. In this sense, discourses on health tend to come very close to morality. Increasingly, people believe that most ailments can be traced back to some sort of sin of the flesh, be it unprotected sex, too much wining and dining, or even enjoying the sun. In many cases, these new forms of thought are based on earlier conceptions of right and wrong. The avoidance of alcohol, for instance, has deep-rooted antecedents in the temperance movement, which in foreign contexts was associated with evangelical Christianity. Number of overheads to show you. This is the first two. This is, of course, a famous engraving by Hogarth. The famous Gin Lane, all right? Now Hogarth is making a point about the dangers of not necessarily alcohol, but gin. This is around, 1750. The Gin Act was passed in 1751. And it prohibited excess gin, etc. And this engraving, it's detailed, but not as detailed as other Hogarth engravings. The reason is that Hogarth produces for the masses. So this was an early form of health promotion, really. But it's, of course, very graphic. This woman here, she's reaching for a pinch of snuff. And as she does so, she drops her baby. So this shows the dangers of tobacco, of alcohol, etc. There are many more. It's not particularly good, but in the background, there's a chef roasting a child on a spit, actually. When in fact, he should be roasting, of course, a side of meat or whatever. So this really shows the dangers of gin. This was very effective. It was one of the things behind a report, an official report, which, as I said, led to the Gin Act of 1751. Hogarth also engraved this is it's a double, and this is Beer Annie. Now, beer was thought to be good at the time. It was thought to be a healthy drink, partly because the water was so dangerous that drinking beer was actually a healthy option in London. And of course, there is a huge contrast here in that Gin Lane shows a completely chaotic society, and Beer Alley shows a very ordered society. We also have to remember that at the time, work or else social dysfunctionality was linked to laziness, the laziness of the working classes. And here, most people are not actually working, or if they are working, they're doing the wrong thing. Whereas in Beer Alley, they're working, painting signs, etc. So this is the society that drinks beer, this is the society that drinks gin, snuff, they take snuff, etc. Incidentally, snuff is making a comeback in Britain and in various European countries because of the smoking laws, of course. I've tried to buy it in Malta, but it doesn't exist. So. The trend to perceive the individual as the locus of responsibility for a number of physical conditions has been noted in Blairite Britain, among other places. Health scares over BSC, cholesterol and such, and government policy and campaigns tend to encourage a sense of individual responsibility for disease. There is an active construction of a new framework within which people can more comfortably live, so long as they adhere to new rules and accept an unprecedented and, according to the critics, an acceptable degree of supervision of their personal lives. Fitzpatrick notes that in contemporary Britain, the expanding range of medical intervention, characterized as the medicalization of life, involves two interrelated processes. On the one hand, there is a tendency to expand the definition of disease to include a wide range of social and biological phenomena. On the other, people suffering from this expanded range of disease are increasingly evaluated in psychological or moral terms. This is also a point that Sontag makes, incidentally. This last point is of great relevance to my argument about the local context, since the notion of morality takes us away from the secular into another deeper-rooted and rather more colorful ballpark. These models of self are, in fact, almost invariably rooted in religious morality. Take alcohol consumption, for instance. I'll talk about Malta now. At Carnival this year, Agencia Seta issued a press release about alcohol abuse, which is worth quoting from. Agencia Seta would like to note that, unfortunately, Carnival festivities offer yet another excuse for excessive alcohol consumption. The first is that alcohol is being consumed excessively in public places, which results in accidents, violence, and other improper behavior. A trend which is being seen throughout village feasts during summer. Carnival is being used excessively in an us-against-them atmosphere, especially because of competitions. One notes a slippage between a secular discourse and one which is rooted in religious morality. If not, why would Seta worry about improper behavior and the undesirable dynamics of village feasts? There is one important consequence of the shift towards individual responsibility. Individual choice presumably originates in and of a certain state of mind. Enter psychology and the language of skills and support. Let me start by noting that the individual is increasingly thought to inhabit a hostile world where dangers, moral and physical, abound. If you thought that Jnana Bay was a haven of tranquility, think again, as indeed Joseph Kassar MP did. True to the spirit of the times, the honorable gentleman turned his back on the sea to contemplate the cliffs and their menacing boulders. No doubt based on alarming statistics of unsuspecting sunbathers crushed to death by falling rocks, he easily convinced the Imjar local council to put up a number of what to me look like traffic signs right on the beach at Jaina. The Dingley local council, on its part, is worried by people falling off rocks and is currently thinking of installing railings along Dingley cliffs to avoid the terrible wastage of life that occurs daily in that place. The list is very, very long. I should just note that children are thought to be particularly vulnerable. Pedophiles walk the streets, bullies lurk in school playgrounds, and unscrupulous advertisers lure them towards a life of sin. The following excerpt from a letter to the Sunday Times by the media coordinator of the Health Promotion Department is telling. May the group from Liceo Vassalli act as a model to other young people and make them aware that passive smoking also kills. Your correspondents should always be aware of the potential nasty sharks, ready to prey on easy, vulnerable youngsters. The Health Promotion Department is not accusing them of any wrongdoing, but bearing in mind that Youth Day has just been celebrated, the department is obliged to act as a general eye-opener as well. Young people should be careful when they are out there. As I said, the list is long and seemingly disconnected. What, to my mind, links these concerns with safety and threats is a particular view of the individual as naturally unskilled and in need of constant education, surveillance, and protection. If the anthropologist Maurice Bloch argued in his 1991 landmark paper that practices such as turning a doorknob are both learned and unsaid, that is, they belong to a cultural field that develops through subtle cognitive processes, it seems that social trends are proving him wrong on the latter point. One notes, in fact, an inflationary use of the word skills. The word, which made its debut in Malta about 15 years ago, by my reckoning, is nowadays used to mean things as conceptually and practically diverse as servicing engines, making conversation at parties, getting invited to parties in the first place, and bringing up children. These are all skills. Since they are ultimately responsible for a growing number of conditions and choices, and also because they inhabit a threatening world, individuals are thought to require an arsenal of skills to enable them to cope. It is at this juncture that the variously shaped pieces begin to fit together, I hope. The formalization of more and more practices into skills that need to be taught creates a bank of clients for professional services. In other words, creates a fertile field for the production of rent-seeking credentials. The timing could not be less coincidental. In fact, the fortunes of psychology, as well as the new approaches to welfare, began to rise about 15 years ago in the beginning of the 1990s. At the time, psychology in the popular imagination was an exotic species for a variety of reasons, not least its silent P. Psychologists were thought to be dangerous mind readers who could look inside people. One could never quite relax with a psychologist around. This image did not take long to change, and by the mid-1990s, psychology had become very establishment. Its terminology, bullying, skills, etc., seeped into popular usage. Meanwhile, new approaches to welfare had come into their own. By the mid-1990s, the various state welfare agencies were in the making, particularly with the setting up of the Social Welfare Development Program in 1994. Various restructuring processes eventually created a number of welfare agencies, today grouped under the Foundation for Social Welfare Services. As the official website states, APOCH has over the years developed a vast array of services aimed at addressing the real and emerging needs of the persons it encounters in the course of conducting its duties. Social welfare services aim at bringing change, and through our services we hope to bring about change in people's lives, change that will enable them to enhance their potential through the support, care, and understanding that they receive from the social welfare professionals that they come in contact with through APOCH. This discourse dovetails very beautifully with the growth of psychology as a field, even as the vast array of services become vaster and absorb more and more psychology graduates. If I may be critical of the profession, there exists an element of self-congratulation that may in fact be self-defeating. Thus, when Minister Cristina says that 11,160 clients made use of these services during 2005, and that this figure represents an increase of 20% over 2004, is she describing a positive or a negative process? A less sane society. This is the mission statement of a POCH, all right? Just to show you the jargon that's used, sort of whatever we do with integrity and dedication, as this is what our clients deserve. Wherever we go as leaders, but the service we deliver is a professional one. Some contributions, my point is that some contributions, I think, mock themselves so effectively that there is very little to add. And in this contribution, the writer of the letter has the final solution to the immigration issue, and that is to provide psychological services to soldiers and to immigrants. Presumably they cope better. In any case, social work is, of course, the second pillar of the new type of welfare, which in turn emphasizes the notion of support. Individuals are increasingly seen as eligible and indeed in need of skills and support, be they children, single mothers, disabled, alcoholics, hyperactive, or simply living in Cotonera. As the Children's Commissioner, this is not making this up, I mean, there is actually a web page with a list of problems, and then the final one is, if you live in Cotonou. It's good to know I'm eligible. As the Children's Commissioner, or many counts as it happened, as the Children's Commissioner recently put it, ideally, the Children's Commissioner, ideally we would have a social worker, a teacher, and a counselor for every school child. Ideally for the social workers and the counselors, of course. I should at this stage add the caveat that the map of the new type of welfare state is not a linear projection, but includes strong distortions. Cotonera, and in particular Cospicua, is seen as the ultimate laboratory for welfare experiments. In people's imagination, it figures as the flagship depressed area. Cospicua, for instance, is at present home to a large number of church-state welfare initiatives. A short walk through town takes one past Darittama, a self-help center for prisoners run by a Dominican priest, Radio Cotoner, Darittama's community radio, an empowerment center for local women to practice yoga and such, run by local adherents of the Indian sect Ananda Marga, a center for children run by the Sisters of Charity, and the government complex of welfare offices belonging to foundations such as APOCH, ACES, etc., and counting. One requires skills and support to choose which agency to go to, you know. With respect to family, the state is taking huge steps towards an active construction of proper types. Since 2003, we have a Ministry for the Family and Social Solidarity, that to many people is already questionable in itself, actually, which, through its various structures, constitutes a means for the active endorsement and sponsorship of the model society. Again, however, one notes a marked lack of division of labor between state and church. The Kana movement, a church-run organization, is sponsored by government to the tune of several hundred thousand pounds a year. The rationale behind this funding is that the movement, via its programs, which are compulsory to all those who opt to get married in church, controls the degree and content of premarital education in Malta. In its mission statement, the Kana movement endeavors to present marriage, to quote, present marriage as a relationship which is lifelong, faithful, and open to life, unquote. What this means is essentially a heterosexual relation which is lifelong, i.e. no room for divorce, monogamous, and avoids contraceptives. A perfectly legitimate stance, of course, but one which is directly rooted in Catholic morality. Given that a majority of Maltese couples attend Kana courses, and that these courses are being partly sponsored by the state through funding and implicitly endorsement, my point on a lack of division of labor becomes a salient one. This explains certain important anomalies. Given the high rates of marriage breakups and the vast armies of social workers and family therapists, one would quite expect the state to come up with suggestions for the introduction of divorce. Because the armies carry both secular and religious banners, however, marriage breakup is nothing except a moral issue that could be resolved. Marriage breakup is seen as nothing except a moral issue that could be resolved if couples loved, ate, and prayed together a bit more. I shall now describe the church's involvement in the two academic fields that are closest related to social welfare, sociology and psychology. the church has been Malta's main sociologist for some time now. The first Maltese to qualify in the subject was the late Reverend Benjamin Tonna, who studied sociology at Louvain in Belgium in the late 1950s. The church continued to sponsor the discipline very heavily, and when I joined the Department of Sociology in 2002, I was actually the only member without a priestly background. Here I should maybe, I had forgotten Professor Baldacchino, of course.
But I was a member too.
In 2002. So we were the exceptions, this is not a criticism, of course. I'm simply describing a situation. Huh? But yeah, that's it. It's one plus point. Religion and secularization have featured prominently in the local. That's coming as well. Religion and secularization have featured prominently in the local social scientific output. Both sociology and anthropology tended to concentrate on religion, faith, and ritual. The difference was that, as Saint Cassia argues, anthropologists saw continuity, as in festive actions, rituals, etc., where sociologists saw change, secularization. Typical titles of doctoral dissertations ran thus: Religion and Social Change in Malta, this is Mario Vassallo's PhD, 1975, The Secularization of the Family in a Changing Malta, Carmel Tabone, 1987, The Transmission of Values in European Malta, Anthony Abela, 1991. At the time of writing, these were all, writing the dissertations, that is, they were all priests. Huh? One should also mention DISERN, the Institute for Research on the Signs of the Times. DISERN, which is run by and answerable to the Archdiocese of Malta, was set up by the Reverend Tonna and is currently headed by Dr. Joe Inguanes, Reverend Dr. Joe Inguanes, until recently a senior lecturer in the Department of Sociology. Let's move on to psychology. I'm skipping a bit. One of the first promoters of psychology in Malta was Father Victor Shields, who obtained qualifications in clinical psychology in Melbourne in 1971. For a couple of years, Shields ran a clinical psychological clinic for Maltese migrants in Australia. Then, in 1982, he moved to Malta, where he has practiced as a clinical psychologist and part-time university lecturer in psychology and theology since. Victor Shields' self-help books and audio cassettes were very popular in the 1980s. Many people didn't associate them with psychology, but at university, the pioneer of psychology was, of course, the Jesuit Father Alfred Darmanin, who holds a PhD in the subject from Berkeley. Like Shields, he doubles as a lecturer in theology. Most of the present members of the Department of Psychology were at some point taught by Darmanin and or his assistant, Mariana Juice, who is now one of the key players at the University Counseling Services section. Through her presence on TV and radio programs, the latter has probably done more than anyone else in Malta to popularize the subject. Maybe I should say that I mention these people with respect, okay? I mean, this is not, as I said, I'm simply describing the situation here, not trying to foul-mouth people. There is, of course, a third academic field that is linked directly to social welfare, social policy. The Institute of Social Welfare was set up in the early 1990s with the late Professor Anthony Abela, then a Jesuit, at the helm. At present, social workers and administrators are trained by the recently set up Department of Social Policy and Social Work, headed this time by Professor Carmel Tabone, a Dominican priest. Many coincidences here. This relationship between the church and academia is highly consequential in a number of ways. First, academics in Malta have a relatively high social visibility, appearing on radio and television shows, writing regular columns for newspapers, etc. Most of the people mentioned above, in fact, are household names. Second, the psychologists, sociologists, and social workers that are being produced by university, in some way or another, bear the stamp of their makers. Third, many academics in these fields are also very active in church control activities and social welfare programs, teaching courses held by the Kana movement for engaged couples, doing their voluntary bit at Caritas Malta, etc. These priests are what I call, in this paper, bridge individuals, people who are produced and produce the dual church-state hegemony over social welfare in contemporary Malta. But it is not only churchmen who may be described as bridge individuals. The process is, in fact, a pincer-moving one in which individuals from both the religious and the secular sides of the equation converge. The list of latter types, that is the ones with secular background, is very long, and I will limit myself to a few of the higher-profile names, again mentioning these people respectfully. Joe Gerada, the current CEO of the Foundation for Social Welfare Services, is very active in a number of church initiatives. He regularly participates in radio programs of a religious nature, for instance, and this year he was even the main guest speaker at the popular Lenten sermons Esercizib Differenza. Charles Buttigieg, the Commissioner for Refugees, is also official spokesman for the Archbishop's Curia. He works closely with Monsignor Philippe Calleja, the man to whom we owe a large number of initiatives towards better conditions for migrants and refugees. One should add that, in this field as in others, most local efforts are run by the Church, the Commissioni Emigranti, Jesuit Refugee Services, Peace Lab, etc. These bridge individuals very often find it hard to overcome their dual role. There was an uncomfortable moment on the recent Bondi Plus edition on child abuse in a church-run home for orphans, when the presenter asked one of his guests, a representative of APOCH, why the agency seems to be avoiding a direct investigation of the matter. Likewise, the Commissioner for Children has had very little to say about this case. This is, of course, in complete contrast to her and APOCH's war of words with the Malta Football Association over the case of a paedophile who apparently, a convicted paedophile, I should add, who apparently was hired as a groundsman by the association. But then the MFA is not the church. The ongoing case of Mario Spiteri, the director of the Health Promotion Department, is an interesting one. A few weeks ago, on national television, Dr. Spiteri had the temerity to suggest, in the gentlest of ways, may I add, that the Diocesan Youth Commission's campaign for total abstinence outside of marriage might not be the most realistic way of combating the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. For one brief moment, church, as represented by the Diocesan Youth Commission, and state, in the avatar of one of its foremost health professionals, parted company. The cataclysmic rift did not go unnoticed. On Sunday, April 16th, Sunday Times columnist Romer indulged in a long diatribe against Dr. Spiteri's ludicrous statements. And I'm quote, quite scary, actually, this article. There is therefore something irresponsible about Dr. Spiteri's attitude. He is not merely being negative when he should be running a positive campaign and working hand in hand with the youth movement to promote abstinence. He is also demonstrating a positive obtuseness when he implies that the movement's campaign is a waste of time, that he should poo-poo, nothing of the sort, incidentally, or even have a crack at holding its vision up to ridicule is disgraceful. Such ludicrous antipathy is not what is required of his job, and it ought not to be what his minister accepts from him. Dr. Spiteri must be responsible to somebody. That somebody should put him right or replace him. To date, Mario Spiteri has not been replaced. He may also have avoided the embarrassment of being put right, at any rate in public. The debate, however, continues in the Sunday Times. I am suggesting to you that this is a direct product of the church-state overlap that is being described. There is another, perhaps more bottom-up, link between the church and social welfare. Many people working in welfare-related fields are recruited at field level via the grassroots social activities of the church. Interviewing a number of facilitators recently, I was struck by how many of them were attracted to the field in this way. And of course, this experience helped them no end in their recruitment interviews. Two had previously worked with disabled children as part of their activities in a village prayer group in Gozo, for example. Another first started taking an interest in care work through his activities as a member, Suochiu, of museum. To my mind, the argument gains in momentum when one considers drug rehabilitation. Through a number of initiatives, notably Caritas, the church enjoys the stewardship of these programs and by diffusion of much of the discourse on drugs in Malta. To his credit, the indefatigable Monsignor Victor Grech has become the national embodiment of the fight against drug abuse. Likewise, Il Programma Tal Caritas is, in people's minds, the way out of an undesirable lifestyle. Living in Malta, it is at times easy to forget that Caritas is ultimately a Catholic organization. As a recent vacancy advert shows, however, secular qualifications and experience in social welfare do not entitle aspiring graduates to join its ranks. For this, they also need sound Christian values. In practice, this means that it is very difficult to work in drugs rehab in Malta outside of church structures. Interestingly, our columnists and political observers often interpret such instances as a failure by government to take responsibility for social welfare. As Daphne Caruana Galizia put it in a recent article, the Maltese government is the only one in Europe to leave the care of unwanted or abandoned children entirely in the hands of religious orders, as late as the 21st century, with not even the slightest sign of debate about shouldering responsibility. Seen against the background of today's talk, however, remember, I'm arguing for a dual hegemony of church and state, we can hardly expect either the church or the state to take responsibility. They both do so together. Earlier, I said that one of the devices of the national discourse and rhetoric on social welfare is that of community. Increasingly, and perhaps paradoxically, society is imagined as a number of individuals and the communities they constitute. It makes sense to try to understand the anatomy of these imagined communities. In general, conceptions of community, both the reason is that many of these welfare agencies use the notion of community in their policies, etc. In general, conceptions of community, both at the level of official rhetoric and that of popular discourse, are very old-fashioned and, probably unwittingly, inspired by Tenney's Gemeinschaft. Put simply, the ideal community is the sum total of a number of ideal individuals. It is united, celebrates together, has fun as defined by the church state, does not litter or deface public property with graffiti, cultivates civic feelings, etc. As a welfare agency website puts it, community social work aims at helping the individual function better within his or her community and to build social networks. In terms of exactly where these communities begin and end, I have not yet come across an attempt to define the criteria for boundaries. Presumably, however, the boundaries roughly overlap with those of locality, which in Malta are articulated through the local councils at present. Indeed, local government rhetoric is very fond of the il comunità locali. At this juncture, however, a unique complication arises. In January of this year, Godfrey Baldacchino and later myself contributed articles to the Times in which we argued that in spite of the lip service paid to the notion of local community, no such thing exists in Malta, other than a vague sense of being an ashari or a mosti with no practical consequences and certainly none that are related to social welfare. The reason is that the heavy and divisive involvement by political parties in local politics has effectively ruled out the possibility of any sense of secular community. I quote Godfrey Baldacchino to himself as it happens, but I didn't expect him today. Disappointed by the crass partnership of local councils, many Maltese have flocked to the local parish to organize or participate in local events that attract people from all political stripes. A solid minority is not turning out to vote when their local council elections come up. And I think the election results actually confirm it. There is no community in Malta, and only the church as parish gets close. But this is not a secular organization, although it performs many useful secular roles. So on the one hand, we have social welfare agencies talking about community. We have to look for this community. We only find in church-related activities. And this role of the church has many facets. As an institution, it is very much aware, in a sociological sense, of its monopoly over local community. This role of the church has many facets. As an institution, it is very much aware, in a sociological sense, of its monopoly over local community. So much so that parishioners are reminded annually that the rationale of Festa is to bring people together, i.e. to overcome partisan, political and other divisions. No harm there, of course, but these communities cannot penetrate the spheres that properly pertain to local councils. They are, by nature and prescription, religious. Besides, the lack of secular community results in a dearth of mature secular debate and discourse. From the corner shop to the national television channel, conversations and discussions on migration, family, education, and a million other topics are usually murdered in the blind alley of superficial moralizing. Arguments from social responsibility are still largely unknown, which is why people often ask in many contexts, il-knisa kif ma tiftaħx ħalqa? Seen in this light, a model of why doesn't the church speak out? Seen in this light, a model of state social welfare which serves local communities begins to look very problematic. Just like individuals, communities are increasingly monitored by the state. CCTV is yet to make an impact on our street furniture, but I have no doubt that it is something to look forward to as soon as we pay off the national deficit. There are subtler, less visible modes of surveillance and control. This is interesting. In her 2004 report, the commissioner for, I thought it was a joke actually, the commissioner for children described one of her priorities for that year. The Malta Skaters United are a group, this I'm quoting for the report now, officially. Okay? The Malta Skaters United are a group of young skateboarders and skaters, mainly between 11 and 17 years of age, so we have them classified. They regularly meet in a subway, which is government property, to skate and have put up skating ramps. How terrible, especially when you consider that the whole of the northern coast is taken. They have been cleaning the area regularly, painting off rude graffiti, and organizing awareness-raising events to promote skating as a sport and alternative leisure activity. Our office has helped the Malta Skaters United in several organizational aspects and guided them to the government offices to get the necessary permits. The Malta Skaters United is currently in the last stages of negotiation with the government. Now, I'm a bit old for skateboarding, as you can imagine, but as I understand it, one of the main ideas behind it, actually, as a subversive sort of resistance, a contract, not have to meet the minister this morning, let's sort of, a contract is being drafted between the Malta Skaters United and the government, which will allow Malta Skaters United to develop the site better. One is tempted to discuss the wisdom of using taxpayers' money in pompous negotiations with a harmless bunch of skateboarders. My points are, however, first, that this is a case of state intervention into people's private lives of the highest order, and second, that the commissioner's emphasis on rude graffiti represents a typical instance of state-sponsored moralizing. But more on this case later, because there's more to this. The model community, therefore, needs specialized spaces where to recreate itself as such, as a model community. The model community needs specialized spaces where to recreate itself as such. Government, especially at the local level, is increasingly involved in the setting up of parks, soft areas, and pedestrianized zones, blue flag beaches, and such. The theme is that of taming and sterilizing public space by installing safety features and 24-hour CCTV surveillance, elaborate multicolored rubbish bins for separation at source, thickets of notices and disclaimers, bollards, circuits that encourage a healthy lifestyle, etc. In Malta in 2006, for example, a beach is much more than a strip of sand. This is the description, new description of a beach now. I'm quoting, the new beach in Bujibba involves the construction of a containment structure for the beach, stormwater and drainage management works, construction of a staircase, an 80-meter-long ramp to provide full accessibility, a beach management room, presumably housing a beach manager, a lifeguard lookout post, and public toilets. A boundary wall has also been built to restrict public access to the site for safety reasons. There is, of course, a meaningful convergence between a model of society that views people as naturally unskilled and prone to mishaps and these various props. In this sense, public spaces are simply the model society in brick and mortar. Soft areas for soft people, as it were. In this sense, it is interesting to look at artists' impressions of those specialized and sterilized spaces. Just like the utopic visions of lions cuddling lambs peddled in Jehovah's Witnesses publications, the architects of our spaces of welfare are keen to include shining, happy people holding hands. One of the consequences of the expanding universe of social welfare in Malta concerns women and politics. One of the few good consequences, I think. One of the most striking aspects of local politics is, of course, the dearth of women. Maltese political parties have never nominated women in significant numbers. Lane, one of the writers, notes that although Maltese political parties have been almost profligate in fielding candidates, this tendency has obviously not accrued to the benefit of women. He goes on to show that once nominated, female candidates tend to fare as well as their male counterparts. The answer to the posture of women in Maltese politics must therefore lie in what Lane calls the secret garden of politics. Cultural sets of predispositions, such as the female gendering of domestic activities, social separation of the sexes, and the allocation of subordinate roles of women. One should note, however, that since Lane's research, the representation of women in the Maltese parliament has increased sixfold. In 1995, there was only one woman, 1.5%, that is, out of 65 MPs. In the present legislature, there are six, 9.2%, still low, but three for each party. All three for the governing Nationalist Party have portfolios. Two are ministers and one is a parliamentary secretary. And two of the three Labour MPs have shadow portfolios. Although current female representation in Parliament is only around, so they're very high profile, very few but high profile frontliners. Although current female representation in Parliament is only around half the EU average, there seem to be good prospects for the gradual erosion of occupational segregation in Maltese politics. I should say that this is part of another. To my mind, three factors acting as catalysts in the increasing participation of Maltese women. The first is women's increasing participation in the labour market, of course, particularly relevant in the case of the professions, and especially medicine and law. The legal and medical professions, professionisti, have classically constituted the primary recruiting fields of Maltese politics. The second is the introduction of local government, which gives much scope for women to draw on their typically well-developed local connections. These two need not detain us here. It's not the topic of this talk. The third, however, is directly linked to my topic. I have been describing a process whereby the state is broadening its scope and penetrating areas which were hitherto considered as private and/or domestic. A look at the portfolio of the Ministry for Family and Social Solidarity, for instance, shows a burgeoning of structures related to family policy, childcare, lifestyle, and social welfare in general, as one would expect, of course. This means that the number of spheres of individual and social life that are being politicized is increasing. Interestingly, since many of these spheres are also female-gendered, traditionally, more women may find themselves taking part in activities that are newly politicized and controlled by the state. Clearly, this hypothesis is just that, at this stage, merits a more systematic examination. So I'm arguing that rather than women going towards politics, politics is moving towards women, as it were, because it is expanding into areas that were considered domestic and private and family related. Throughout these formulations, well, not necessarily a bad idea, of course, but throughout these formulations, whether they deal with walkers who need to be warned about the slippery path at Busquets, have I shown you?
Yeah.
A chocolate-loving public who cannot tell a joke from a chauvinist manifesto, I'm referring to the UOK advert, or unsuspecting swimmers about to be crushed by a cascade of boulders, a jnana, we are presented with individuals who are naturally unskilled, naive, and prone to physical and psychological mishap. These individuals need to be educated, or better still, empowered. This is another catchword. To make informed choices about their lives. As a representative from Agencia Seta put it in a recent interview for the Malta Today, I quote, "It is important to stress that we, as Agencia Seta, the national agency against the abuse of alcohol and drugs, in case you forget, are in no way trying to interfere with young people's right to enjoy themselves. On the contrary, through our prevention programs, we empower and encourage people, especially young people, to have fun. This, however, should be done in a healthy way." This is the point, really. Empowerment proceeds along the lines of what is perceived as physically, psychologically, and morally healthy by the church, state, and its subjects. Earlier, I drew a parallel between Malta and Britain. Indeed, Tony Blair's New Britain, in most cases, provides the model for this type of welfare. I haven't studied this, but this is I haven't studied it extensively. In Malta, this is readily understandable, since individual biographies, most of our individual biographies in this room, of achievement and specialization have developed according to a particular historical geography, which takes Maltese graduates to British universities for further studies and then back to Malta as specialists well-versed in the language of the metropolis. Further, because of the power hierarchies implicit in this geography, Malta's past as a British colony, the prestige of Britain as a contemporary world power, etc., the process of acquisition tends to be a relatively unquestioning one, I think. The only aspect of Britain that tends to be questioned is the weather, in fact. There is, of course, the issue of language. Terms like empowerment, soft areas, skills, binge drinking, bullying, etc. Partly because it is much harder to play with a language that is not one's mother tongue, and also because these terms sound technical because they are in the language of the metropolis, Maltese initiates find it hard to keep tongue firmly implanted in cheek, as any British person with the slightest tinge of liberal education would. In Malta, there is no private eye, no liberal criticism based on good old British common sense, whatever that means. There is just a prestigious terminology, imported wholesale and sold not tale quale, but spiced up with local flavors, religious ones. Now I'm going to discuss some theoretical aspects as well. I want to keep on giving details. The political aspect of church-state hegemony in Malta has, of course, constituted the focus of a number of social scientific studies. Koster's 1981 work, for example, Prelates and Politicians in Malta, where I borrow the title of the stuff, Bessevan's various writings, and a number of works on 20th century history. Today I have sought to look at another aspect, itself embedded in politics, of this relation. I shall now outline my developing thought on its more theoretical aspect, without which my earlier discussion would be essentially a rant on church-state versus the people, which is the last thing I would like it to be. Really. In 1984, Orwell's unlikely protagonist, in 1984 the book that is, Orwell's unlikely protagonist, Winston, at one point muses that if there is hope, it lies in the proles. Later in the novel, he seems to change his mind. The proles, he comes to realize, are an uneducated bunch who cannot be expected to see past the silly songs and cheap propaganda mass-produced by the party. Orwell's proles are passive, mindless automatons, as are the controlled, in fact the only intelligent prole turns out to be a member of the party, ultimately. As are the controlled masses in a number of scholarly and semi-popular models that see social welfare strictly in terms of social control. The notion that has been so predominant as a means of understanding the relation between state and subjects. There are many reasons why a rigid model of social control doesn't work. First, the distinction between state and society is never straightforward in a parliamentary democracy. Indeed, Cohen and Arato coined the word social stat to account for the blurred distinction between the two that occurs as a result of increasing democratic pressure on the state to respond to an ever larger range of constitutive interests. Second, as Foucault, for instance, argues, it is simplistic to see the state as the locus of power. Van Krieken, on whom I draw for this conclusion, sums it up beautifully. The view of social welfare as, I'm quoting, as either an agency of social control or a vehicle for disciplinary strategies and techniques appears to retain the status of a central myth in the historical sociology of welfare. Like all myths, it organizes our perception and understanding of power, which disables us from grasping either the basis of social stability or the sources of social change. The bone of contention is, of course, the role of the prole. When the objects of social control respond at all, this is in scholarly literature, that is, their action is generally construed as one of resistance. Even in Foucault, who does overcome a rigid top-down approach, subjects are usually restricted to acting out technologies of the self as opposed to the technologies of power of the state. So even Foucault, in spite of the fact that he overcomes this top-down approach, he's still really, in a sense, allocates power to the state. In part, the problem of the undervaluation of the subjects derives from scholars' reliance on rhetoric and official policies and models, on intent, that is, at the expense of effect. But there is more to it. in actual fact, when one examines the secret garden, you know, social welfare, one often finds that the relation between states and subjects goes well beyond resistance to include not just acceptance, but positive encouragement. Pardon me. People tend to have an active desire for a more active state that expands into monitors and structures hitherto private areas of their lives. To my mind, the evidence from contemporary Malta supports this argument. State intervention and welfare, including a more extreme, including the more extreme forms such as the traffic signs at Jnana and the skateboarding negotiations, are in general positively welcomed by people as a sign of good governance. In their perceived absence, one hears things like shtel aun, kul ħadd jagħmel li jrid, and the rather sweet abandonship. Concerns about the nanny state or social control are little more than a bourgeois scratching post, rearing its bourgeois scratching post, how shall I put it, evident after a few drinks at middle class dinner parties, if at all. This positive encouragement creates pressure on the government to expand its reach. Thus the controlled become the controllers. Let me tangibilize it by looking first at two false positives. Phenomena, that is, which in spite of appearances do not actually challenge a top-down social control model. First, the growth of a consultation culture. This is one of the latest innovations. The fact, that is, that the recipients of social welfare are increasingly being integrated into structures of ostensibly grassroots consultation. The newly formed Children's Council, for example, includes among its members a number of children, the idea being that policymakers should first listen to what children themselves have to say. The problem is that these consultation interfaces are embedded in church-state power structures again, and they generally end up reproducing official versions of the model society. Judging by the proceedings of the Children's Council, for instance, which I sort of checked out, it would seem that Maltese children's two greatest concerns are bullying and passive smoking. In this case, not PlayStation. In this sense, the consulted become rather like Stalin's advisors. The first challenge, therefore, is at best a very mild one. We all know what Stalin's advisors were up to, of course, telling him the things that, like, yeah, exactly. The second aspect concerns the media as a form of popular consultation. So the official consultation we have, well, I think I have dispatched, but you know, we have another form. Most discussion programs now feature text messages, phone-ins, public audiences, etc. One must not, however, underestimate the power of the producer. Priests, politicians, and psychologists, in tandem, are regulars on programs such as Sharabank, and I have my beloved Sharabank. And I have even heard a priest describe Jesus on radio as a role model. This is interesting. To describe Jesus as a role model. He's the son of God, according to a role model. I mean, a professor could be a role model, not Jesus. And this is being said by a priest. You know, the discourse of psychology and gets... The bridge individuals discussed earlier are, of course, standard fixtures on these programs. I find that these public consultation exercises tend simply to reproduce the structures of power. But then someone told me, a sharabank is just that, a route bus going round in circles. So far we have haven't really enfranchised the proles. One could easily, remember, we're trying to talk about the role of the prole. One could easily argue that official and popular consultation are simply two more devices of social control foisted upon the people by a powerful church-state hegemony. There are, however, other instances that do indicate a more interactive approach, I think. First, in my earlier description of the skateboarders case, for example, I left out one important element. The Malta Skaters United welcomed the attempt by the state to structure and tame them, going so far as to thank the Super Commissioner for Children on their website. The second example concerns surveillance. 3 weeks ago, Minister Nino Zamit inaugurated new paving and street furniture in the Kirkop Parish Square. In his own short speech, there were quite a few of them, which presumably was intended to put him in good stead with his electorate, saying things that his electorate would like, the mayor of Kirkop stressed that more surveillance of local neighborhoods was needed, and that the council had plans to install CCTV in a number of places. The Coppin, the people of Kirkop, like the rest of the Maltese, want day and night surveillance of their lives by the state. The third example, which concerns the relation between the state and its most vulnerable subjects, or perceived as, is perhaps more complex. Children's time is very structured and formalized in Malta. Now, I'm just starting to study this now. I'm doing some time diaries of different children. But this is my sort of preliminary. More than half their daily waking hours are taken up by school homework and private lessons. What is interesting within the context of this talk is that increasingly their time off is being roped in by other structures. So, the time, local councils are doing their bit to occupy what little time is left after school. One of the electoral promises of the San Juan local council, for instance, was to run after school crafts courses to avoid, as they put it, children wasting their time hanging out aimlessly. Bishop Falmayo Odushijirubarani. For thousands of school children, the summer holidays are no longer a chance to waste time playing and swimming. The government-run summer school, Skola Saif, offers the opportunity to students to be educated while using their holidays in a creative and productive manner. It also helps their families put their minds at rest, knowing that their children are in a safe place, not in that dark, murky, pedophile-infested world out there. In 2005, 3,600 children attended daily morning sessions between 14 July and 5 September. The chosen theme was children as committed citizens. Children actually spend their summer holidays committing themselves to the state. What the state does not get goes to the church and other organizations such as band clubs. The church enjoys the stewardship, and here I have to acknowledge my ongoing conversation with Professor Baldacchino by email, but very useful. The church enjoys the stewardship of rites of passage, and most Maltese children attend daily doctrinal classes run by museum. The upshot of these various burgeoning initiatives is that children's time, give or take a couple of hours at weekends, is increasingly integrated into church-state structures. This also means that the time interface between the individual child and these structures is increasing. And yet, and this is the point here, all of this is welcomed by parents and, I dare say, I stand correct on this one, by the children themselves. British Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, Tessa Jowell, whom The Guardian has called more Blairite than Blair and the ultimate queen of nannydom, the Mary Poppins of the Blairite state, right down to the apple cheeks, has defended her social engineering, the one who doesn't know her husband, has defended her social engineering program by stating that, quoting, no one has ever come into my constituency surgery and said, what we really want is for you to stop nannying us. For once, I believe her. Given this empirical reality, I find Van Creeken's remarks particularly revealing. The historical critiques of theories of social control suggest that it is essential to develop a sensitivity to the ways in which particular patterns of family life and social interaction have developed in relation to a given economic and cultural environment, independently of, as well as in response to, state action and attempts at social and psychological regulation, unquote. In this brief paper, I have sought to outline the ways in which new directions of, I stress this is work in progress, okay? I have sought to outline the ways in which new directions of social welfare in Malta are embedding themselves, maybe increasingly, in a political and cultural milieu characterized primarily by a church-state dual hegemony. There is, of course, much more to add, empirically as well as theoretically. I haven't said much about, for instance, the historical background of church-state relations. I could also myself be confused of confusing intent for effect from relying too much on brochures, internet sites, newspapers, snippets, and rhetoric. So there is more grassroots research to be done. There are also many other aspects of the new social welfare that lend themselves to intellectual scrutiny. There is a contradiction, for example, in that at the same time as society is said to be more inclusive, rigid models of individual, family, community, sex, fun, and so forth are being peddled that presumably create new categories of misfits. Dare I mention smokers here. Another internal contradiction concerns the notion of empowerment. At the same time as more and more people are empowered, and therefore presumably more powerful, more and more individuals, families, and communities are being described as vulnerable, and therefore in need of help, support, and professional skills education. Be that as it may, my hope is that this short paper may stimulate a scholarly and intellectual interest in the structures that pattern our lives.
Thank you very much, Mark, for an exploration which was both very wide-ranging and at the same time very, very fine-grained. You've covered such a variety of areas of multi-social life, and I think raised a hornet's nest in the sense that you attack a number of different constituencies, some of which juggle inside my own heart and mindset, that I don't know whether to agree with you or to attack you.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series. The talk was entitled, God Protect Me from My Friends, Prelates, Politicians, and Psychologists in Contemporary Malta, and was delivered by Dr. Mark Anthony Falzon.